Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. A little bit of history. 75 years ago today, President Franklin Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066. This order resulted in the internment of more than 100,000 Americans of Japanese descent. Now, I've spoken to some people about this, and one fellow told me, we took away almost everything we could that was American from them, but we weren't able to take one thing, and that was the national pastime. Tune into America or check out AmericanWarriorRadio.com for our programming notes. We hope to have one of the young men who participated in baseball behind barbed wire coming up here in a couple weeks. Should be a really interesting interview. Make sure you keep an eye out for that. Between February 5th and 7th, 1917, over 6,000 U.S. troops completed their withdrawal from northern Mexico, part of a punitive expedition sent in by President Woodrow Wilson. These soldiers were ordered to cross the border following Pancho Villa's March 9th, 1916 attack on the community of Columbus, New Mexico, which resulted in the death of 10 civilians and 8 soldiers. In a press statement, Wilson said, an adequate force will be sent at once to pursue Villa with the single objective of capturing him and putting a stop to his forays. This can and will be done in entirely friendly aid to the constituted authorities in Mexico and with scrupulous respect to the sovereignty of that republic. Over the course of the next year, U.S. forces penetrated several hundred miles into Mexico and engaged in several skirmishes. Acting on intelligence that Pancho Villa could be taken at the town of Carizal, Chihuahua, Pershing sent the 10th Cavalry to investigate, and they soon found themselves in a pitched battle against Mexican federal troops, not Villa's rebels. 27 Mexican troops were killed, including General Felix Gomez, and this action brought the U.S. to the brink of a full-scale war with Mexico, and negotiations which began after that effectively ended the punitive expedition. Now, pertinent to today's discussion is not only the fact that this month is the 100th anniversary of the end of that expedition, but also the fact that the officer who was chosen to lead that action was Brigadier General John Pershing. In assembling his forces for the expedition, General Pershing specifically requested the 10th Cavalry based at Fort Huachuca. He had commanded them in the Spanish-American War and knew full well their capabilities, and they respected their actions. Now, if you recognize the 10th Cavalry reference, it's because they are one of the cavalry units who gained worldwide fame as the Buffalo Soldiers. Last year, 2016, was also the 150th anniversary of the creation of the Buffalo Soldiers. So joining us today to talk about both those items, I think, Mike.
Yes.
We're going to talk about the punitive expedition as well as a little bit more about the anniversary of the Buffalo Soldiers. Joining us in studio is Dr. Michael Ings. He's a retired educator with Pima Community College. He was a historical interpreter for the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation, and since 1983 has also been researching the history of African Americans in the Southwest and has become, I don't know, Michael, are you the official historian for the Buffalo Soldiers in Southern Arizona, unofficial?
Oh, no, not anywhere near that. Just a formal, informal person who just loves history.
Suffice to say you're an expert.
I can say that.
Okay, well, that's good enough for me. Now, Michael, I find it interesting, you've got a PhD, your master's is in counseling?
Yes.
And your PhD is in educational leadership?
It's actually an EDD in educational leadership from Northern Arizona University.
Okay, I don't see history anywhere in any of that.
Well, it's because I decided not to study history as a formal pursuit, because when you study history as a formal pursuit, you'd have to take it pretty seriously. And I, as a reenactor, historical reenactor, I like to dress in costumes, I like to tell stories, and I don't want to be in the academic structure where my lectures and everything is fact-checked and I have to publish or perish and all the things you have to do. So having history as a hobby is an awful lot more fun than doing it as a major occupation.
Now, you were just talking about your mother is celebrating her 100th anniversary.
Yep, July of this year.
Well, happy birthday, Mom, out there. Is she listening?
I doubt Myrtle's listening to me.
Okay. What first inspired you to get involved in history, and particularly the depth of the research that you've done with regards to the Buffalo Soldiers?
Well, I grew up in Williamsburg, Virginia, and for many of your listeners, I'm sure they realize that Williamsburg is a historic restoration. Mm-hmm. You know, back in the 30s, Rockefeller gave the city of Williamsburg $88 million to recreate the city so it looked like it should in the time of Thomas Jefferson. And so my first job in high school was as an interpreter at Williamsburg, doing different crafts, talking to people every day, and basically living history. And from that day on, I was captured by that activity. I'm still a reenactor here. I do a lot of volunteer work with the Tucson Presidio Trust. I own a business called Arizona Heritage Tours. We can do 6 costume changes in a day. We can take you from Tucson through Tubac to McCockery down to Nogales, tracking the 500-year history of African Americans in Arizona. So to me, history is just a lot of fun.
Well, and we were talking outside in the parking lot as we're coming in about just how important it is, and people will get this in the context of what we're talking about today, how absolutely essential both of us believe that people read history, that they know history, so that they're able to contextually examine what's going on in the present and down in the future, hopefully, because I don't know what the famous quote is, if you don't know your history, you're bound to repeat it or something.
Well, there's so many parallels in history because it does keep repeating itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the theme of my talk this year and next year and into 2018, is indemnity. Indemnity is a legal term, and what it says is that if you have the obligation or duty to protect another person, then you deserve gratitude and reward. And the question has always been, as you were talking about just before we came on the air today, we don't reward our veterans and those who fight for our country. It's been true of the Buffalo Soldier 10th Cavalry during the Punitive Expedition. It's true now with the soldiers coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq. So history keeps repeating itself, and unless we see that pattern, we can't correct that pattern and take care of the people who are taking care of us.
Very, very well spoken. Now let's talk a little bit about, before the first break, if we can squeeze it in, we're just coming off the 150th anniversary of the establishment of the Buffalo Soldiers. That was June 28, 1866, when the Act of Congress authorized the creation of two cavalry and four infantry regiments. Their role here, particularly for the listeners here in southern Arizona, I mean, certainly it's fascinating for everybody listening nationwide, but their role here in the desert southwest was critical during that period of time because there just wasn't a lot out here, particularly when it comes to force protection and the things that you're talking about.
Oh, yeah. If you think now of civil service and all the functions of the federal government, the Buffalo Soldiers were basically performing those functions. You know, if you're talking telegraph lines and protecting the mail and protecting the railroads, protecting settlers, protecting us against bandits, preventing hostiles from the indigenous tribes from attacking everybody. Those were the roles of the Buffalo Soldiers. So they were, in a sense, the arm of the federal government for almost everything. And when revolution broke out in Mexico in 1910, they were a thin blue line of people who were going to protect the Arizona Territory at that time.
Very thin. They were stretched from Yuma to what, Naco?
Yeah,
almost over
when,
to Douglas?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, when the attack on Columbus, New Mexico in January of 1916 occurred, which was the first attack since the revolution began in 1910, so they must have been doing a fairly good job to protect us. It's not that Americans were not being attacked. You know, we have lots of incidents down in Mexico. Mm-hmm. January 1916, I think it was, when the Cusi mining engineers, there were 17 of them, were massacred down in Mexico, and then, of course, the attack on Columbus, New Mexico by Pancho Villa during that same year.
You know, one of my favorites, and we'll talk more about this gentleman a little bit later in the show, but I think a lot of folks didn't know that the Buffalo Soldiers were, in effect, also our very first park rangers.
Exactly. One of my favorite stories, because I'm a mountain biker, I've just finished riding the loop trail all the way around the circumference of Tucson, is that some say that a group of them rode from San Francisco Presidio to Yosemite National Park because they were plundering the park. After it was declared a national park, there was nobody to protect the resources there. And so a group of them rode on bicycles all the way from San Francisco.
Bicycles?
Yes. First mountain bikers.
Okay, I get the connection there. So
mountain bikers.
Now, the Smokey the Bear hat, I've heard, is that the, you know, kind of the symbol for the park rangers? Was that taken from the cover that those soldiers of the period wore, do you know?
Well, all the soldiers of the period wore that hat.
Okay.
You know, that was a change in uniform that occurred probably just after the Spanish-American War of the late 1890s. And so most of the pictures that you see of Pershing even show that particular hat. So I think that's why they adopted it as a symbol for, you know, firefighters and Smokey the Bear and that sort of thing.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined in studio by Dr. Michael Engs. We're talking about the Buffalo Soldiers in general, and in particular the centennial of the end of the punitive expedition against Mexico. In nearly 30 years of frontier service, Buffalo Soldiers took part in almost 200 major and minor engagements. From 1870 to 1890, 14 Buffalo Soldiers were awarded Medals of Honor, the nation's highest award for bravery. Elements of the 9th and 10th Regiment also fought in Cuba during the war with Spain. In 1941, Two regiments formed the 4th Cavalry Brigade and were commanded by General Benjamin O. Davis, Sr. And why else you should recognize his name, Benjamin, like I said, Colonel Benjamin Davis, I guess at the time, Michael Craig McFerrin, was also became the commander of the famous Tuskegee Airmen. Stick around, folks. We'll be right back. Feel free to give us a call. The lines are open, 520-751-1041. We'll be right back. Take care. Welcome back, folks. Your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. I'm joined live in studio by Dr. Michael Engs. We're talking about the Buffalo Soldiers in general. This is about their 150th anniversary of the founding of those cavalry and infantry units. But we're also talking more specifically, this is the 100th anniversary, the centennial anniversary of the end of the punitive expedition where troops were sent into Mexico in pursuit of Pancho Villa. The Buffalo Soldiers, particularly of the 10th Cavalry, had a huge role and that expedition, and in fact, were specifically requested by General Pershing when he was put in command of that, that expedition into Mexico. Now, Michael...
Well, they didn't want to call it an invasion because, remember, Woodrow Wilson was really trying hard to stay out of World War I. The Americans were not in favor of going to war in Europe. They didn't see it as their war, and so he was trying to soft-pedal as much as he could any talk of invasion or war. And remember, at this particular time, the Germans were fomenting a lot of violence in Mexico against Americans in order to push America into a two-front war with Mexico.
Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, we were talking about context in the last segment. That's very important to remember in this instance of what was happening on the border, what was happening in Mexico with the revolution. And then, was it the Zimmerman telegram? That was the telegram that
was... Well, what's more, I think what the story that fascinates me was called the San Diego document. It was a rebel general in Mexico had met with a group of people who were later discredited by the Mexican government, even though we think the Carranza government, Pancho Villa, and some of the other people in Mexico rebelling at the time were involved, which suggested that the Mexican-Americans and Mexicans on the border should basically go to war with America. And then after taking over, they would get back all the land that they had lost in the Mexican War. We're talking California, Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona. And then that they would free, then they would give all the lands back to the Apache if they would rise up and fight at the same time. When that document surfaced, of course, it really scared a lot of people along the border.
So at that time, we had Buffalo Soldiers. We talked about they were strung out all across the border from basically Yuma to Naco to enforce what was then called the neutrality law. And I, if you don't mind, I'm gonna read this because that was a very confusing situation. And yeah, I'll hold on to this because I've got you. But I mean, I found a description in the Fort Huachuca newspaper about the description of that basically says, okay, neutrality laws, you're down here to enforce it. What does that mean? I don't know. The general tells the colonel enforcer. Colonel doesn't know what it is. He tells the captain enforcer. Captain doesn't know what it is. You know, drifts on down to the sergeant, down to the corporal, and pretty soon folks are out there not knowing why they're there, but they're trying to enforce this. But it was very difficult because, as you mentioned before, at this time we've got Mexicans fighting each other on the other side of the border, and particularly in the case of the Battle of Naco, those bullets didn't stop at the border.
Yeah, and happened they came across on several occasions, in Brownsville during the same year. You know, you have bullets coming from rebels on the other side of the border because there's nothing to block them. So, yeah, it's a very frightening time for Americans because they can see the revolution continuing on in Mexico. And it's just a matter of time before they realize it's gonna come across the border. And in January of 1916, Pancho Villa's attack on Columbus was a perfect example of that. 12 people were killed, and it just got to the point after several atrocities in Mexico against Americans, like the Cusi mining engineers, 17 mm-hmm, of them mm-hmm. riding on a train in Chihuahua, were taken off the train. All their Mexican employees were set free. They were summarily executed, all killed except one who came back to tell the story. So there was a lot of fear along the border, particularly in Texas and the Arizona Territory, New Mexico Territory at this time.
Now, the Buffalo Soldiers were enforcing, basically, you know, they're trying to hold the line, or they're holding the line to make sure, try and keep the war from spilling across. But you did have, as I understand it, Mike, a lot of the weapons and the supplies that were fueling people participating in the Mexican War were coming across the border. So it was also their job to keep stuff from going south. But then you had these bandits come across all the time, stealing cattle, doing whatever they could, creating havoc on this side of the border. So it was a very rough period even before the assault in Columbus.
Yeah, it's almost reminiscent of what we go through today. You know, the border is unprotected by all intents and purposes by small groups of people who just want to come across, because there's no way to keep that many people from coming across. You know, nothing is going to stop people who really want to come across. And even today, we struggle with that particular issue. But, you know, the other group that was very much involved at this particular time were the Yaquis, because the mm-hmm. Mexicans were basically mm-hmm. suppressing the Yaquis in central Mexico. And so their relatives here in Arizona were trying to ship them weapons back and forth, causing even more havoc along the border. So it wasn't just about a Mexican revolution. It was about a whole explosion, conflagration of different people fighting against each other. And the people on the border here in Arizona were reticent to get involved in that.
Now, the match that lit the powder keg was this attack in Columbus, New Mexico.
Yes.
Were any of the Buffalo soldiers in Columbus?
No, the units there were mostly units of Anglo soldiers from the, I believe, the 13th Cavalry at the time. What happened subsequently was that when General Pershing was assigned by President Woodrow Wilson to go into Mexico and attack or capture Pancho Villa, mm-hmm. he then called upon the 10th Cavalry Buffalo soldiers. They marched 250 miles from Fort Huachuca to join in the fight. They then marched into Mexico. They were there for several months. They had several engagements, one of which was fairly critical to them at Carrizal, as you mentioned earlier. And so it was a very, very hectic time for the America and the Buffalo soldiers.
Now, historically, as far as military history, also, correct me if I'm wrong, Michael, you're an Army veteran yourself, so you know about this. This is one of the first times that motorized vehicles were actually used in a military expedition, and to some extent also aircraft.
Exactly.
Providing reconnaissance.
Exactly. We were moving into the weapons that we then saw being used in World War I several months and years later. And one of the things that was being used for transportation were touring cars. They looked like huge convertible limousines. The trouble was the roads were not so good in Mexico at the time. And so they broke down. And so as a consequence, what you had is you had to get mule trains to deliver supplies. And pretty soon the mule trains were going hundreds, if not thousands of miles into central Mexico to deliver supplies to a very thin line of soldiers trying to find one man, Pancho Villa.
Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, also, Wilson campaigned on a platform of keeping America out of the First World War. So this was a very sensitive time and a very sensitive situation for him. But I think just a clamor after the attack on Columbus, he just said, okay, we've got to get this fixed. Now, there's lots of skirmishes or battles that were involved with the Buffalo soldiers during the punitive expedition. Let's talk first, or too much to talk about in just an hour, but let's talk about the Battle of Agua Caliente, because that was, I guess, one of the first cavalry charges mm-hmm. in a long time, right?
Oh, yeah.
Led by the Buffalo soldiers.
Right. Colonel Charles Young. Basically led a group of people on horseback. There's a description in an excellent recent biography of his called Black Officer the Buffalo in a Buffalo Soldier Regiment by Brian Shellum. And it's describing Colonel Young riding on horseback, pistols blazing downhill. It's also one of the interesting thing is one of the first recorded incidents in which a American unit used machine guns as supporting fire in battle, which would become a very popular tactic in World War I. The part that disappeared was the charge on horseback, because obviously we learned at the Battle of Carrizal later in that same year that you don't charge barbed wire trenches
and
machine guns.
Yeah.
On horseback. And in that particular fray, several Buffalo soldiers were killed, 23 were captured, but it's probably one of the most interesting stories of the punitive expedition because of Wilson's reaction.
Now, what's interesting to me, I pulled up some research here and is talking about from people that were there. Colonel Young ordered Major Young to charge the position with troops H and F, and the soldiers, buoyed by the prospect of being part of the first real cavalry charge since the Spanish-American War, leapt to the saddle, drew their 45s, and swept down on the Villistas wall. As they increased the speed to their gallop, withholding their fire, they began to yell, and the Mexicans ran off into the woods to their rear. Captain Troxell described the outcome of the clash. He says, "We never saw these Villistas as real opponents again. None of our men were hit, and the horses were the only part of our command that had not enjoyed the skirmish."
Exactly. Exactly.
So basically, they chased off the Villistas, and not a single man. I think there was one horse maybe killed or wounded, but not a scratch too.
Yeah, that's why some of the subsequent battles, like the one at Carrizal, was so serious, because we lost a lot of men there. We really shouldn't have been in that fight. Mm-hmm. Pershing had given Captain Boyd, who was in command of that unit of the 10th Cavalry, orders to scout to the east through to find a large contingent of Mexican troops, because they felt that their supply line was stretched so far down to Para, hundreds and hundreds of miles into Mexico, that they really had to make sure that there was no large Mexican force. Because originally, you know, the Carranza government was encouraging them to, you know, chase Pancho Villa to take pressure off themselves. Mm-hmm. But at some point, you know, it became clear to the Carranza government that it was not a good thing for Americans to be that far into Mexico. And so they began hostilities against us.
And let's talk more about that after the bottom of the hour. But when we first come back, Michael, I want to talk about Charles Young, because he's such a fascinating character. And what a pillar in the African-American community military leadership. And a lot of great stories about him. Folks, your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, here on AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Give us a call, 520-751-1041. You can find archives and podcasts. Visit AmericanWarriorRadio.com. On Facebook, American Warrior Radio. Stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back, folks. Your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, here on American Warrior Radio. I'm joined in studio by Dr. Michael Engs, who is a historian, an amateur historian, if you will, but very, very good, an expert on the Buffalo Soldiers here along the southern border, particularly in southern Arizona. We're talking about the Buffalo Soldiers, particularly in the context of the punitive expedition into Mexico in 1916-1917. Mike, Charles Young is, to me, when you talk about military history, one of the more fascinating characters, for several reasons. We were talking before the break about him leading the first cavalry charge since the late 1800s in this action during the punitive expedition. The challenges he faced, not just as a member of our military and a military officer, were, I don't want to say unique, but in the context of the time in which he grew up,
They were somewhat unique. You could use that word.
Okay.
Yeah, I think unique is a good word, because you have to realize Charles Young was only the third black graduate of West Point in its history. And during that time, he and Henry O. Flipper before him mm-hmm. were shunned by all people. Can you imagine going to a school for 4 years? He actually stayed there longer because he was deficient in engineering and mathematics at some points in his academic career while he was matriculating through West Point, so he had to stay longer. But he was really not talked directly to by his professors or any of the other students.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't imagine going to any school for 4 years and not being able to interrelate and talk to the people around you. And instead of reacting to it with anger, he became a musician. He learned how he played the violin. He played the piano. So he was a very centered individual. And to be the third black graduate, and what's very striking about that is it took, over 50 years after his graduation in 1889 for another African-American to graduate from West Point.
Oh, I did not know that.
So you can really sense how powerful an experience he must have been having to go through that.
And I tell you, you know, under perseverance, they should have his picture in the dictionary, because, I mean, literally, when you talk about the transition, historical transition, he was born into a family of slaves.
Yes.
I mean, he went from slavery to West Point. And his father, as I understand it, escaped, ran away, joined one of the colored regiments during the Civil War, and that's how he sort of won his family's freedom. You know, Charles was, as I understand it, was also, he attended an all-white high school, graduated at the top of his class, went on to West Point. Now, it's interesting, I heard you talk, he had 140 demerits at West Point, which was probably owing to the fact of the prejudice at that time. But let me, you know there's going to be a quiz, but you're a teacher, so let me tell you, there's going to be a quiz.
All right.
Who was one of the persons at West Point that had the highest number of demerits ever?
Custer.
There you go. That's right. 726
George
commands.
George Armstrong Custer.
Yeah, and there's some irony there because he refused to serve with black soldiers.
The
right?
greater irony is that one of the major units to fight with the 10th Cavalry as they went into Mexico against Pancho Villa was the 7th Cavalry Gary Owens, which was Custer's former unit that was left over from the massacre at Little Bighorn.
And when they got in trouble, which cavalry came to rescue them?
Well, the 10th Cavalry and the Buffalo Soldiers have rescued more than just them.
Yeah, yeah. So,
you know,
some,
the
some.
Stories, you know, you told the story of the service in the Spanish-American War in Cuba,
mm-hmm.
and how in a later conversation between Buffalo Bill Cody and Teddy Roosevelt, who's given the heroes a role in the Spanish-American War for his charge on San Juan Hill, and Buffalo Bill is telling Teddy, you know, if they hadn't come up, those black soldiers hadn't come up on your flank, you may have lost that battle. And Teddy Roosevelt said, yeah, you're right.
Well, you're an Army veteran yourself. I never served, but the importance of fighting for the man beside you, I think, still carries over. Now, the interesting thing about
it's always been an interesting question, because several years ago a person here in Tucson asked me that question: why do people fight?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a particularly interesting question when you talk about the Buffalo Soldiers, because remember, all the way up to this period of the punitive expedition, ever since the Spanish-American War, the question in the black press in large cities like Philadelphia and New York and Washington D.C. and Atlanta was, why are we fighting these other people of color when they're treating us so badly here? I mean, if you look at the Woodrow Wilson administration, which started just before the punitive expedition, one of the things they were doing is purging all African Americans from their employment in the federal government. Woodrow Wilson's wife was from Georgia. She really didn't like the fact that she was seeing an integrated environment in Washington, D.C. that it had grown up in prior administrations. Mm-hmm. So she wanted all those African Americans out, all the way down to postmen walking the beat. And so as a consequence, it was an extremely ironic period in the fact that the Buffalo Soldiers were protecting our southern border, while at the same time there were daily lynchings, which created the NAACP. My favorite story about Charles Young is the fact that on the day he came back from the punitive expedition, he sent a check to the Anti-Lynching League.
Oh my gosh.
Of $600. Now, thinking about how much that was in his salary, it was very significant. And he had to write a letter to his wife explaining why he was doing that. So here you have one of the heroes of the punitive expedition writing a check to the Anti-Lynching League on his mm-hmm. return from Mexico. That's the irony.
Boy, when you talk about context.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, we talked about the park rangers, too. As I understand, he was the first black U.S. National Park superintendent.
Sequoia National Park.
Okay. And mm-hmm. was that when he was based at the, or posted
Presidio?
At the Presidio?
Right.
Okay, in San Francisco.
Right.
And then, you know, this is, I talked
You know,
about,
and the other thing a lot of Arizonans don't realize is the Presidio is actually an extension of Tubac and Tucson. Because remember, the original group that went to establish the San Francisco Presidio came from Tubac in October of 1775.
And the Spanish soldiers.
And if you look at that group of 280 families, remember, Anza had taken a group to the Presidio earlier that year. And then in October of 1775, he realized they weren't going to stay up there unless he took a group. Of the 280 people he took, mostly families, a third of them, according to the National Park Service, were of African descent.
Mm.
So these were the people who preceded the Buffalo Soldiers in the Presidio almost 100, 200 years earlier.
Now, when you talk about perseverance, I also understand, Colonel Young, I think he was a colonel at the time, he very much wanted to lead his black troops in France during the First World War. This guy is 53 years old. He rode on horseback from his home in Ohio to the War Department in Washington, D.C., 497 miles to show them, I'm still fit, I'm still ready to serve, but he was not sent overseas to France.
Exactly. There was still some reticence on the part of the American government to recognize the presence of black officers in the military. That story is very close to me because my father, Robert Nathaniel Ings, was one of the first black officers commissioned by Truman when he integrated the service in 1945. And that's why I grew up in Europe, why my father was serving in Europe during the first 7.5 years of my life.
Let's just talk about sort of towards the end of the punitive expedition, the battle, and you've referenced this a couple times, the Battle of Carasol. Walk our listeners through again what happened there. That was, in most cases, from what I can tell, Mike, we won most of these skirmishes, but that one didn't turn out. I mean, if you just want to count as far as losses, it was a win for us, but it was a very bad situation. Basically, our folks were led into an ambush.
Right. I'm not sure you can ever describe Carasol as a win for us.
Okay.
When you're talking about the number of Buffalo soldiers who were killed in that battle, the fact that there were 23 who were captured in that battle, the fact that it really set the tone for the now retreat of the American Army out of Mexico at a time when we really needed as much confidence as we possibly could have if we were going to go to war in Europe. I can't see that we can call that a victory. What I think is so interesting about that battle, and remember what was happening there is our supply lines were stretched hundreds of miles south into Para. And so as we came back out of Mexico and as we supplied the troops who were already in Mexico, Pershing decided that he needed a scout both east and west in order to really determine whether or not there were large Mexican forces that were going to attack his supply line.
Mm-hmm.
So Carasol is not really that far into Mexico. It's just south and west of El Paso. And there were supposedly a large contingent of Mexican troops under the Carranza government at Ahumada. It's called, I have the name right here in front of me.
So in essence, while you're looking that up, I mean, our soldiers from the 10th Cavalry were looking for Villa, but they ran smack into federal troops.
Exactly, yeah. At Villa Ahumada, that's where they thought a large contingent of troops were going to be stationed, but they had to go through or around Carasol. And the general said, no, you're not. You're not coming through the city. You know, this is our property. This is our land. And Captain Boyd, who had been warned by Pershing not to have a direct confrontation with Mexican troops at this particular time, just did not obey the order that he had received. He interpreted it differently. And now you've got a group of Buffalo soldiers who are charging a force that's dug in with trenches, mm-hmm. barbed wire, and machine guns that is five times their size. And it became a disaster. The Buffalo soldiers showed their normal bravery in the battle. But as I said, a number of them were killed, 23 were captured, and at that point, we really realized that this chase of Pancho Villa into Mexico was really going downhill fast. It was going south, and we couldn't sustain it.
And at that point in time, also, given what was happening in Mexico and what was happening in the U.S., that could have easily led to an all-out direct a war between the U.S. and Mexico. As you mentioned before, we got the Germans down there stirring up trouble. It was just a bad environment overall.
Exactly. Which makes it so ironic and so interesting that Woodrow Wilson, in finding through General Pershing that 23 Buffalo soldiers had been captured by the Mexican government, immediately said to them, if you don't release those Buffalo soldiers, we're going to have an all-out invasion of Mexico. And we've got like 20,000 troops on the border at that time. Mexico wanted anything but that. And so they immediately released those soldiers. Now, you have the situation that we talked about earlier, where you have daily lynchings of African Americans all over the country, mostly in the South, but all over the country. You have the purging of African Americans from the federal government, and yet Woodrow Wilson is going to threaten all-out war on the eve of World War I with Mexico to free 23 black people? That's pretty ironic. That is one of the most amazing stories in American history right there.
Yeah, to what extent do you think that was because of General Pershing himself, though? I mean, do you think he was pushing that up the ladder, or?
I'm not sure with the respect that Pershing had in the military at this particular time that he alone could have pushed that.
Okay.
All the way up to the president. I think the Secretary of State, Secretary of War, many of the other people in the Woodrow Wilson administration would have resisted that. I think what it was the history of the Buffalo soldiers. Remember, we're talking about the 150th anniversary this year.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look back at their whole record of service, I think what was striking Wilson was a record of service of military people. And military people tend to be very tight,
mm-hmm.
especially in battle. Like you said, you're fighting for the man next to you. So mm-hmm. I think what may have been happening there is he realizes that inevitably we're going to war in Europe. And if he insults any portion of the military, he's going to have a really hard time recruiting young men from America to go to war in Europe, thinking that when push comes to shove and they're captured by the Germans in Europe, they're not going to be protected by the American government.
Very, very good point.
It's very tactical.
Folks, your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking about the Buffalo Soldiers, in particular the punitive expedition into Mexico with Dr. Michael Engs. If you want to give us a call, if you have a question or comment, feel free. The lines are open, 520-751-1041. We'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Ben Bueller Garcia here on American Warrior Radio. We're joined in studio by Dr. Michael Engs, who's an expert, an amateur historian, but an expert on the history of the Buffalo Soldiers, particularly here in southern Arizona. We're talking a little bit about the punitive expedition into Mexico and how that eventually wrapped itself up on the eve as we were just about to enter World War One. Michael, that wasn't the end of things, though. And you touched on, when we talk about the period of time in African-American history, in particular members of the military, we're going into world. Well, let me just. You touched on something that I did not even know about. We just the Buffalo Soldiers' big role in the Indian Wars, Medals of Honor, pretty much, you know, the folks down here taking care of business, not just here but up in the Midwest as well. But I think I and maybe a lot of people, when we talk about the Indian Wars, we think about the late 1800s. But that wasn't. Tell us about the last battle, if you will, or the last conflict in that context.
Yeah, the Buffalo Soldiers didn't leave Arizona. They returned to Fort Huachuca after the punitive expedition. One of the stories I particularly like, and it's the favorite of my wife, is that because of their isolation, the women, their wives, were basically creating a whole community, schools and churches and church groups and sports teams and all kinds of things. You see pictures from 20 years later of people at Fort Huachuca in the church choir, and all these women who were living out in the middle of nowhere, creating this environment for their children and the men who are descendants of the people who fought in the punitive expedition. But their role was not over, because remember, as we talked about earlier, there was a lot of foment and confusion on the border up and through this time, and one of the areas of focus for the Buffalo Soldiers was the fact that the Native Americans, particularly the Yaqui, were being persecuted in Mexico because of their value of their land, and their relatives here were trying to help them by either helping them come to this country across the border or getting weapons to them. And in January of 1918, what we find is the last major Indian battle on the continental United States at Bear Valley, just west of Nogales. There was a border fight in Nogales where, you know, bandits had come across earlier, but this particular incident is particularly interesting in African-American history and Yaqui history. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think really the Yaqui side of the story could be as compelling and as interesting as the side of the story from the Buffalo Soldiers. But what occurred is they captured, the Buffalo Soldiers were told by ranchers that the Yaquis were basically slaughtering their cattle, when in fact most of the cattle were winter kill. They had died during the winter because it was a very harsh winter between 17 and 18. And so they were scouting along west of Nogales looking for Indians who may be poaching cattle. And they ran into a large force that they really couldn't count because it was dark, and there were many more Native Americans, indigenous people of the Yaqui tribe, than they really could count. But in the end, after the battle was fought, 13 of them were captured. One, who was the leader, was killed because a bullet struck his gun belt and bandolier. Mm-hmm. Bullet exploded, and basically he died that night. But of the 12 people that were captured, they were sent to trial here in the United States. And the charge was weapons violations.
Oh, boy.
When they counted the number of weapons, there was only 13, and there was only 13 of them, and everybody carried a weapon at this particular point in time. So I guess they owned the weapons, but still it was a violation somehow. The judge found them guilty and then released them on their own recognizance into the hands of the Buffalo Soldiers. Soon after, a letter came up from the Mexican government saying, we need for you to deport these Indians. The judge decided that, knowing that they would be killed in Mexico by the Mexican forces, said, well, we can't do that because basically they've already been tried in our country, and that under our laws would be double jeopardy. And so that kind of reaction to the interrelationship of Buffalo Soldiers and Native Americans and the government of Arizona is completely unique in that we would protect a group of people from another country from persecution by the Mexican government. And it's really, to me, the concluding story of our whole relationship with Mexico during 1916, 1917, and 1918.
Now, you talked about how that three-year period was a real distinctive period in the history of African Americans, the Buffalo Soldiers, and particularly the military. Expand on that a little bit, if you would, because there's a lot of change going on in the world. Not just, we talked about just the technology.
Well, when I did this talk to a group at Quincy Douglas Neighborhood Association, seven police officers from the Tucson Police Department were there, and I made the parallel that what we see happening both now and then is that those who protect us are not always respected until we need them. And the same thing is occurring now. We want the police to be there if our houses are broken into, but we don't want them around necessarily if everything is fine. And the same thing was true of the Buffalo Soldiers in 1916, 1917, 1918. They were needed on the border because of the incursions of Pancho Villa, but when all was said and done, we sent them back to Fort Huachuca to live, because it was as isolated as you could get.
Would you say that, and correct me if I'm wrong because you're the expert, I'm not, but I've always claimed that Fort Huachuca is the only Army post that can rightfully claim to be the true home of the Buffalo Soldiers, because all those cavalry or infantry troops at some point spent time at Fort Huachuca, and I don't think there's any other Army post that can claim
that.
Yeah,
I think you're right about that. I would be reticent, though, because I've traveled as far north as Utah and Weber State. I did a lecture on the Buffalo Soldiers in Utah. They created communities wherever they went, mm-hmm. and I think that's their legacy, is despite, and again, the theme, indemnity. If you're protecting other people, you deserve pay mm-hmm. and gratitude. Utah and many of the other states that they served in, they were not given that respect. And I think it's time for us to give them the respect that they deserve and to give others who defend us the same respect that they deserve.
Now, there is an initiative here to create a memorial in South Park of Tucson, and that's going on now. What can you tell us about that, or how can folks get involved or help out?
Well, just last week we met with Councilman Richard Fembrace of Ward 5. He's a very strong supporter of this memorial to be set up outside the Quincy Douglas Library mm-hmm. Down on Keno Boulevard and
Keno and 36.
36.
Yep.
And the library is very interested in creating more displays of African American culture around this particular monument. And it'll be a light in the history of the Tucson area that highlights the contributions of African Americans, which is long overdue.
Absolutely. I did some work down in that neighborhood, and what a great, you know, if people don't know the area, they might consider it has a bad reputation, but what a great little community down there and a lot of history there. We do have a caller wants to chat with our expert. Paul, you've got a question for Dr. Michael Engs. I don't know if you'll be able to answer this, but maybe, Mike, you'll take a stab at it. What's your question, Paul?
Yeah, the question is, when I was in the Navy, I guess it's about 25 years ago, I had a civil service guy, African-American guy working for me at the Naval Air Station. He commented that he was in a troop of black Americans riding horseback in the Southern California mountains in the Second World War, protecting us against invasion from the South. What do you know about that?
Well, I'd have to know a little bit more about the unit that he's referencing that was in Southern California during World War II. There were several units that were being converted from what we traditionally call the Buffalo Soldiers, the 10th, 9th, and 10th Cavalry, and the 24th and 25th Infantry. During the World War II period, I met a gentleman who fought in Saipan in the Pacific Theater during that period of time. So I'd really, Paul, need a little bit more information about maybe unit designation, the guy's name, When you do research like that, those are the facts. But if you know his name and you know a little bit about his unit, if you go back to the National Archives and you look up that unit, you can probably find out a lot about him, especially their military service records.
Well, he was the reason I was kind of interested, he said that was the last time that the Army had a fighting troop using horses. So that should come under your bailiwick, I think.
The last, no, I'm not sure that was the very last time. But again, if you can stay in touch with us, we can perhaps give you a little bit more information on that.
Hey, Paul, thank you so much for your call. We're going to have to cut it off here. We're running out of time. Dr. Engs, thank you so much. Folks, listen, go to ArizonaBuffaloSoldiers.org. They've got a fundraising event coming up on the 25th. You can find out more information. As usual, visit AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Until next time, all policies and procedures are to remain in place. Take care.